Our next speaker is David Breckville, and he'll be talking about Senta's ballot on records. So let's have your attention, please. Mr. Breckville teaches music history, jazz history, and music theory courses at Doan College in
Crete. Nebraska,
thank you. He received musicology degrees from the University of Iowa and University of California, Berkeley. His PhD dissertation at Berkeley was titled The Bayreuth Singing Style around 1900 and investigated the relationship between written and recorded evidence and gaining understanding of that controversial style. He has contributed chapters to Wagner in Performance, the Wagner Compendium, and the forthcoming Cambridge Opera Handbook on Wagner's The Flying Dutchman. He reviews classical recordings for the BBC Music Magazine and Lincoln Journal Star. An active pianist, in the last year he has participated in performances of Schubert's Winterreise. Thank you, I'm a jazz guy, sorry. Handel's Messiah, Orff's Carmina Burana, and Ludoslavsky's Variations on the Theme of Paganini. Let's give a nice round of applause to Mr. David Breckville.
I was told to make 100 handouts. I hope that many goes around. When I first approached Jim Farrington about the idea of giving a paper on Wagner at this particular session or during this conference, I pointed out to him that May 22nd was Wagner's birthday and asked him if it would be possible to arrange to have this paper delivered on that day. Well, here we are, so what you are about to hear is my 186th birthday tribute to Der Meister. Okay. In the spring of 1840, an ambitious young German composer, intent on becoming a major figure in the operatic world, submitted a prose sketch of the legend of the Flying Dutchman for the consideration of the management of the Paris Opera. Richard Wagner's hopes were twofold. First, that the famous librettist Eugène Scribe would be assigned the task of versifying his literary work. And secondly, that Wagner himself would be asked to compose the music for the resulting libretto. All this would be a mere prelude to the glorious production at the Opera. In order to convince the officials that he was able to fulfill such a task, he composed three numbers from the opera at the time he submitted the prose sketch, and seems to have played those excerpts in an audition. Of course, Wagner's hopes were dashed. Although he did sell the script, Scribe was not involved in crafting the eventual libretto for the opera. Indeed, Wagner's script was not even the basis for the unsuccessful opera on the subject composed by Pierre-Louis Philippe Dietsch, which sank from view after a short run of performances in 1842. This well-known tale deserves retelling in the present context because it's important to remember that the music Wagner initially created in connection with this dramatic subject consisted of three songs: the chorus of Norwegian Sailors, the chorus of the Dutchman's Crew, and Senta's Ballad. Wagner himself was responsible for finessing this point a decade after completing his own opera on the subject. In his communication to my friends of 1851, he insisted that Senta's Ballad was the kernel or seed from which the whole opera grew, conveniently suppressing the fact that at the time of the ballad's genesis, it was simply one of several songs to be included in the opera. I will contend that the conceptual weight which Wagner's hindsight placed on this ballad has unfairly colored our understanding of its nature, and thus prevented us from investigating the expressive possibilities it originally offered. Nevertheless, with a century of recordings at our disposal, we can document a considerable range of interpretive possibilities for this song or aria, and this presentation will consider some of the issues involved. A description of the ballad is in order as a point of departure. While her friends spin and sing, Senta is absorbed in thought about the Flying Dutchman whose portrait hangs on the wall and whose tale the matron Mary has apparently sung to the girls on numerous occasions. Senta becomes annoyed by her friends' attempts to get her to join in their activities, and as a diversionary ploy sings the ballad herself for mutual entertainment when Mary declines to do so. The ballad tells the story of a sailor condemned to roam the seas in search of a woman who will be true to him till death. A brief orchestral introduction featuring the Dutchman theme is followed by an unaccompanied vocal one based on earthy nonsense syllables. After this, the ballad proper commences. It is in three stanzas, of which the first two are all but identical. They can consist of passages I shall call the ballad theme, redemption music. The only difference, apart from text, in the second stanza is that the maidens join Senta in singing the second part of the redemption music that we just heard. In the third stanza, there are more differences. Notably, the final phrases of the ballad theme are presented gradually more slowly and inwardly and quietly than before. And after the storm material has run its course, the opening phrases of the redemption music are sung by the maidens alone. In answer to their question in singing that music to the hypothetical Dutchman, "Where will you meet the one who will be true to you till death?" Senta leaps up and in an ecstatic coda prays that she will be the one through whom the Dutchman will attain redemption. Before investigating the realms of interpretation, there are a few textual matters to clear up. In Wagner's original manuscript, the ballad was in A minor. Wagner's tonal plan was thus to begin Act II with the spinning chorus in A major, to move to the ballad in A minor, then to conclude the scene with the maiden's exit chorus in A major. In preparing for the premiere of the opera at Dresden, however, Wagner's Senta, the famous and inspirational prima donna Wilhelmine Schroeder de Vriendt, found the tessitura of the ballad too taxing, and so Wagner transposed it down a step to G minor, retaining that transposition when he finally published the opera. It was not until his grandson Wieland Wagner's wildly successful Bayreuth production of 1959 that this key was questioned. Wieland used the original manuscript as the basis for his production, and although broadcast recordings show that Leonie Riesenek sang the ballad in G minor in the production's opening year, sometime after the very young Anya Celia replaced her in 1960, the production reverted to Wagner's original key of A minor. Thus, the 1961 Phillips recording is the only official recording of this obviously authoritative textual option. To say that the ballad was transposed to G minor is technically correct, but has led to some confusion in even the highest levels of Wagner scholarship. One can read in the New Grove Dictionary of Opera, for example, that in its operatic context, the ballad is even more startling transposed than in its original form because it involves a sudden drop in tonality. Here a tonality is established of A major. There's a trill on a low A in the violins, tremolo. And then there's the drop, okay? So it's not in the same key. The 1961 recording and the published edition of the original manuscript both demonstrate, however, that the transposition takes place some 28 measures before the orchestral introduction to the ballad. I'll now play the 1961 recording and point out the place at which it does not affect the transposition. Transposed version was hovering over an A, is now hovering over a B. Thus, the apparently disorienting drop is part of Wagner's original version, whereas it is meant to be a resolution to the primary key of the scene. One further reading from the 1961 recordings offers a more questionable alternative for a crucial moment in the ballad. The transition from redemption music to Senta's coda in the third stanza is one that looks great on paper but often fizzles in performance, getting the Senta and orchestra coordinated to burst forth from fraught silence without a hint of caution is extremely difficult. Here's an example of a less than perfect performance in that regard. This starts at the second half of your example one. You might look at that. Wagner no doubt recognized the perils this moment offered and seized on an ambiguity in the manuscript as a way out of the difficulty. Example one is taken from the 1841 edition, which was published in the 1980s. In Wagner's original score, the choral sopranos have a crescendo leading to their last syllables, their high note, but not the subsequent decrescendo present in the lower parts. Wieland's solution was to extend this crescendo through the last notes and to have Senta break in as its culmination. It's a striking solution, but its justification is practicality that alters the apparent sense of the motion of the notation by ignoring the fermatas that conclude the section. If Wieland Wagner was the first to adopt the original manuscript as the basis for production at Bayreuth, he was most definitely not the first to consult it. In preparing her 1901 production of The Flying Dutchman, the work's first at Bayreuth, Wagner's widow Cosima tracked down as many versions of the score as she could find in order to establish what she considered the definitive text. In general, she chose Wagner's later revisions, which brought the work more closely in line with the later music dramas. But her reading in the original manuscript of the ballad struck her as more successful than that which had become standard. The standard version of the vocal introduction, see your printed example 2, launches each of the four segments with the syllable yo, except for the quieter third one, which ends up reading ho ho hoe. I believe that Cosimo is correct in finding that reading implausible. Indeed, many singers of the role did and imposed consistency on this third segment by starting all four segments with yo. And so I can only imagine her joy on discovering that the original 1841 manuscript offered ho yo hoe instead. See your printed example 3. Her conviction that this is the correct reading was apparently so strong that she firmly instilled it in her first senta, Emma y Destine. At any rate, this unconventional variant, which appears only in the original manuscript, turns up on all three of Destine's recordings of the ballad. Indeed, her 1911 recording goes overboard by adopting Hoyo as the first two syllables of the first and second segments as well. Although early recording technology was adequate to preserve such details, we are all familiar with its important inadequacies. Among these are numerous sonic deficiencies, the fact that the unnatural physical environment of the recording studio probably distorted the work of the performers in some way, and the fact that what could be included on a single recording occupied sometimes far less than 5 minutes. This latter consideration is important for the ballad, since in its entirety it occupies something approaching or even well over 7 minutes. The handout included lists all the acoustical recordings of this excerpt or portions of it of which I am aware, and this is a result of just one small excerpt from a discography of acoustical Wagner recordings that I've been compiling for the better part of 2 decades. The recordings with the shortest available time span, 7-inch records or 2-minute cylinders, are numbers 15, 32, and 37, none of which I have heard. And presumably they rush through one stanza only. Some slightly longer ones include the introduction, the vocal introduction, and then a conflated version of the first and third stanzas. Examples of that would be number 4 and 26. And this is all made clear by the notations about what's included in the recordings. You can consult that later. 2 single-sided 10-inch recordings for the Favorite label, numbers 20 and 30, omit the vocal introduction, but then race through the first and third stanzas complete, but with a considerable cost in the tempo that's taken. If the third stanza is sung and no chorus is at hand, a decision needs to be made. Should one omit the redemption music altogether, as in 9, 16, and 34? Or should one play the redemption music instrumentally, either complete, as in number 2, or cut, as in 1 and 22? And should Senta sing the redemption material? And if so, what text should she sing? Should she sing the choral soprano's line, as in numbers 10 and 28, or Senta's line from one of the earlier stanzas, as in numbers 14 and 21? All of these and other options have been tried. Suffice it to say that either some sort of editorial modification, or some alteration in performance style, or both, affects all acoustical recordings of this excerpt, since there was no complete recording of it made during that time. Even the one double-sided 12-inch recording, number 3, which would offer the most opportunity for such an achievement, includes one stanza per side. Not until the Elizabeth Rethberg recording on 2 10-inch Victor sides a few years after the end of the acoustical era was there to be a complete recording of this aria, and until the introduction of the long-playing record, such a treatment was exceptional due to intractable recording formats. If the recordings listed on your handout are not equivalent, either in completeness or in the relative renown of the featured singers, so too they were intended to be used in different ways. Perhaps the most intriguing recording in this regard is the 1909 gramophone recording by Eva von der Osten, number 35, if you care to take a look at that entry. It is part of a series of recordings inaugurated that year by the German branch of the Gramophone Company, the goal of which was to allow singers to simulate the experience of making music with leading vocal artists in the privacy of their home. Toward that end, these recordings were made with very distant, often all but inaudible, piano accompaniment, and were then issued along with sheet music containing a specially produced version of the orchestral part arranged for a small ensemble, such as two violins, viola, cello, bass, flute, clarinet, and piano. Since the recordings depend on listener participation for their effect, and lack self-sufficiency when heard on their own, this series of recordings, though it involved such luminaries as Carl Jern, Paul Knupfer, Ernst Krauss, Friedrich Plaschke, Minnie Nast, and of course Eva von der Osten, this series was a resounding flop and received extremely limited circulation. None of the recordings made especially for this series is listed in the Rigler Deutsch Index, for example, and numerous advanced German collectors with whom I am in contact claim never to have seen or owned one. I don't have the von der Osten recording of Senta's Ballad, but I have managed to stumble across a copy of Carl Jern's recording of the prize song from Die Meistersinger, and will give you a sample of it on the assumption that you most likely won't hear another example from this series soon, nor will I. Pretty good, but the lack of accompaniment sort of destroys it. The passage in the opera that the ballad most resembles, in The Flying Dutchman, that the ballad most resembles, is the beginning of the overture with its juxtaposition of the stormy Dutchman theme and the lyrical Senta redemption theme. The issue of tempo in the overture is rather complicated. In 1894, George Bernard Shaw praised Felix Mottl's conducting of the piece, writing that his allegro was a true allegro con brio as marked and not the customary allegro pomposo. What Shaw fails to remark, however, is that the metronome marking and the tempo instruction are out of sync. Here is a recording of the beginning of the overture that moves at Wagner's suggested metronome marking of dotted half equals 72. And the Munich Philharmonic. Out of more than 50 performances I've measured with metronome in hand, this is the slowest and the only one that's this slow. The rest range over an even continuum up to dotted half equals 108. Okay, that's Fritz Busch. In other words, allegro con brio means something very different to conductors than dotted half equals 72 does. Most likely, the performances Shaw ridiculed for adopting the customary allegro pomposo were trying to make a nod in the direction of Wagner's metronome marking. The metronome marking for the Senta Redemption theme, quarter note equals 100, does not exactly contradict the tempo indication of Andante. Here's an example of that tempo, quarter equals 100, Paul Pirie, the Detroit Symphony. Willingness to observe this tempo, however, founders unreceived tradition about the tempo relationship for these two sections. A majority of conductors closely approximates a 1-to-3 proportional relationship between the tempi of these two passages. So, for example, dum bum 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 turns into dum bum bum bum, or within a tick or two, one direction or another of that. Of the remainder, the majority have a tempo or a metronome marking that is considerably slower for the andante than for the allegro, so that you get dum bum 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 turning into dum bum bum bum, or some similar relationship, some more drastic kind of thing. The reverse, having a tempo that's a pulse that's faster for the andante than for the allegro, is practically never found. Roger Norrington is one. Okay, so as a result, this makes quarter note equals 100 something that we don't often find in the performance of the overture either. Recordings demonstrate conclusively that using the 1-to-3 proportional relationship as a starting point is firmly ingrained in traditional understandings of the overture, and Wagner's 1844 metronome markings are erratic enough to make one less than adamant about enforcing them in the absence of compelling evidence that they are definitely what he was after. I believe, however, that there is a stronger case to be made for taking the metronome markings seriously in the ballad. Here, both tempo instruction and metronome marking are slower than for the allegro in the overture, and so the Dutchman Storm material is generally performed much more quickly than the metronome marking suggests. But the ballad contains material not present in the overture, namely what I have called above the ballad theme. It is traditional to play the orchestral introduction to the ballad in the 70s to 90s range, but then to drop to the 40s or even slower for the ballad theme itself, only to resume a tempo in the 70s to 90s for the storm material that follows. Here's an example of that practice, starting with the ballad theme. This sort of treatment is so traditional that it's hard to hear it as wrong. Nevertheless, it seems not to have been what Wagner was aiming for. Not only does he not indicate any change in tempo or metronome marking from the orchestral introduction up to the Senta Redemption music, but we have evidence from Cosima Wagner's diaries concerning his understanding of this passage. On 7 September 1881, she reports that during a visit by the Wagners to Dresden, the conductor Ernst von Schuch, who had conducted a performance of the Dutchman the previous evening, stopped by for a chat, in the course of which Wagner, quote, was able to put him right about the tempi, particularly in the ballad, beginning too slow, continuation too fast. Another entry from 17 October 1878 reveals that Wagner, quote, is also thinking of revising Senta's ballad, the beginning of which he finds quite properly like a folk song, but not characteristic of Der Holländer. In short, Wagner wrote and conceived the ballad as a folk song that needed to move nimbly. By the end of his life, he was beginning to have second thoughts about how appropriate such a treatment was for this important moment of the work, and would have liked to revise it in the direction of the dark, serious tone of the opera as a whole, but objected to using heavy tempo as a means of effecting such a revision. Of the 80 recordings of the arias I've heard, only two approximate dotted quarter equals 63 for the ballad theme, and those are the two 10-inch romps on Favorite by the two Gertrudes, Koppel and Runge. The considered performances that come closest to this marking are by Janice Martin and George Schulte, who go at about 52 in the 1976 Decca complete recording, and the Joan Sutherland Richard Bonning performance of the ballad alone from 1978, where the tempo is in the mid 50s. Neither is ideal in all respects, but I'll play the former because Schulte is more intentional than most conductors about keeping the difference in tempo between the ballad theme and the storm material at a minimum. So he's at 52 for the ballad theme and low 70s for the storm. Particularly the ballad theme, becomes such a ponderous thing in our understanding. The blame seems to lie with a combination of related factors. First, Wagner's claim that The Flying Dutchman was the work which set him on his true path as an artist, and his dubious assertion that the ballad was the seed for the work as a whole. Second, the influence of the 1901 Bayreuth production, which definitively established the Wagner canon by giving The Flying Dutchman the status of a music drama, or at least a proto-music drama. Third, the feeling that the kernel of such a work must be substantial and weighty in dramatic import and, by extension, in the tempo used to project it. And fourth, the relative lack of agility in the work of most Wagner singers. Recordings show that at the beginning of the century, there was a wider variety of solutions to the ballad theme than we currently hear. One of the most startling to our ears comes from Johanna Godsky, who decisively interrupts metrical momentum with a huge retard at the end of each phrase. Similar approach comes from Emily Ulrich, although here the first two phrases are one unit. One of the distinctive problematic features of the ballad theme is the opening note of each phrase. This pickup, or anacrusis, as the highest note of each phrase, is liable to be sung more loudly automatically, and in the original manuscript, Wagner additionally accented each of these notes at the beginning of each phrase, a partial explanation for why Anya Celia in the 1961 Phillips recording is so vigorous with them. In A minor, remember.
Okay.
In the first orchestral edition, by contrast, Wagner placed an accent only over the pickup to the first phrase. And in the first vocal score, he added no accents at all. Other editions sometimes show staccato markings, even apart from the staccatos that are in the third stanza. This inconsistency perhaps reflects Wagner's uncertainty concerning how to get singers to feel the music correctly, and his uncertainty is exaggerated by the varying responses of the singers who need to project it. Maria Yaritsa treats the anacrusis as light staccato notes, a solution that has been much ridiculed, although perhaps unfairly. She writes in her autobiography about the need in the recording studio of that time to lean back whenever you sang a high note and lean forward when you were going to sing a normal kind of phrase, and you can maybe imagine her doing that in the way she sings this. In the third stanza, Barbara Kemp, who was the Bayreuth Sente in 1914, applies portamento to the connection with some of the following notes in some of the phrases. First Emmy Destine recordings from 1906 do not draw particular attention to these anacrusis through articulation, dynamic, or duration. But in her 1911 recording, she introduces a rhythmic distortion which unhappily weights down this phrase, and which we've heard in some later recordings already. Namely, she applies an agogic accent to each of the anacrusis in this passage. I apologize, the pitch is slightly below where it should be. As other singers, too, began to operate under the assumption that The Flying Dutchman was a music drama, this touch gained widespread currency. Even among the acoustical recordings, we hear this treatment from, in chronological order, Katharina Fleischer-Edel, Emmy Destine, Melanie Kurt, Lily Hofgren, and Frieda Leiter. This approach has vied with, and often combined with, energetic attacks of the anacrusis for supremacy in our understanding of how this passage should go ever since, and has culminated, for now at least, in the Deborah Voigt James Levine monstrosity of 1994. My time is up, and there are countless facets of this fascinating aria that I have not had time to explore here. I hope to do so in print before long. If I have spent a disproportionate amount of time on the treatment of the ballad theme, that is because I believe it is the section of the ballad which stands in most need of rethinking. Once our conception of it is altered, the other passages will fall into place. That's a project for the future. For now, I'd like to leave you with the first stanza of the performance I would nominate as the most satisfying I have heard. It's a 1943 radio recording by Maria Mueller, and its secret is in her vivacity of declamation. which seems to produce the vocal line rather than being grafted onto it. Her clarity of rhythm and attack are also major assets in bringing this aria to life, even though her sound has matured and loosened from its prime estate by 1943. Nevertheless, Mueller has so thoroughly synthesized engagement with and projection of the text, with fine vocal technique and profoundly musical instincts, that her communication is consistently direct. Until performers can be convinced to lighten fundamentally their conception of the ballad, and actually the Flying Dutchman as a whole, Mueller's approach in general, and her resourcefulness in dealing with both contrasts and details, seems to me to approximate an exemplary realization of this aria. Attention, I'd be happy to entertain any questions or comments. Vince said maybe two. Yeah.
Conductor for the Maria Miller.
Arthur Rother.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I learned something.